ticklish business any way you look at it. Come on, we'll stick together.
It's Ticklish Business, the podcast devoted to honoring and deconstructing the world of classic cinema. As always, I'm your host, Kristen Lopez. Alongside TCM, April is going to honor Centennial star William Holden. So guest Diana Bosch is going to join me this month, but in this episode specifically, we're going to be talking about 1950s Sunset Boulevard.
Hedda Hopper speaking. I'm talking from the bedroom of Norma Desmond. Don't bother with a rewrite, man. Take this direct. Ready? As day breaks over the murder house.
Yes, you'll read the big black headlines about Norma Desmond and this Hollywood scandal. But you'll never read the true story about the rest of us who were part of it. Me, for instance, Joe Gillis, a promising young writer from Dayton, Ohio. And Betty, that nice kid I met at a Hollywood party, who knew nothing about me, but knew what she wanted.
Before it was a film, Sunset Boulevard was known to most Californians as a street, connected to filmmaking since 1911, after the first major movie studio was built there. Sunset Boulevard started off as a place where film workers lived humble lifestyles, and it wasn't until the 1920s the big celebrities built even bigger houses on Sunset, turning it into the site of glamour that is known as today. By the time director and screenwriter Billy Wilder, a devotee of Hollywood and America since his days living in Berlin, arrived in the 40s, Hollywood had changed significantly. The arrival of talking pictures left many silent-era stars living lives of isolation and obscurity in the grand movie palaces they bought when they were successful. Wilder asked himself how these stars must feel knowing that, quote, the parade had passed them by. What did they do with their time? How did they feel about Hollywood's neglect of them? He teamed up with writing partner Charles Brackett in 1948 to work on a script that would, hopefully, answer those questions. Almost immediately, the two were at odds, since Brackett initially saw Sunset Boulevard as a comedy, about a forgotten film star who gets the spotlight back on her. The two eventually added in D.M. Marshman Jr. as scriptwriter and turned the film into a more cynical examination of fame for the post-World War II era. Eventually, they crafted the story we now know, focused on aging film star Norma Desmond and her fractious relationship with Hollywood in general and smooth-talking screenwriter Joe Gillis in particular.
I thought this was an empty house.
It is not. Get out.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry you lost your friend. And I don't think red is the right color. Wait a minute. Haven't I seen you before? I know your face.
Get out, or shall I call my servant?
You're Norma Desmond. Used to be in silent pictures. Used to be big.
I am big. It's the pictures that got small.
Paramount, the home studio for Sunset Boulevard, was terrified of a movie that so openly criticized Hollywood and its history. They also knew the story of an older woman living in sin with a younger man wouldn't pass muster with the Breen Commission. Wilder himself thought other studio heads would threaten to stop the project entirely. Paramount gave the movie a working title of A Can of Beans in an attempt to hide it. They also refused to give the code offices a full script, parceling out a page at a time. More than just writing a story about Hollywood's past, the film found its biggest challenge in casting. It said Norma Desmond's character has shades of Mary Pickford, Mae Murray, and Clara Bow within her, as well as actress Norma Talmadge. Back when the film was still being prepped as a comedy, Wilder and Brackett initially solicited Mae West to star in the titular role. West, very Norma-like, refused to even look at an outline. To her, the idea of playing a fading film star was hard to believe, because she was still a great star. Once the film transitioned to a drama, Wilder went to Mary Pickford. Unfortunately, Pickford felt the role of Norma was too small, since it was a supporting role initially, and Wilder thought this would make Pickford too difficult to direct. Pola Negri was also offered the role, but her thick Polish accent prohibited her. Eventually, George Cukor suggested Gloria Swanson. Swanson was Paramount's leading lady during the silent era, and after her career, she ended up packing her bags to go to New York to host a talk show. But Swanson also refused the role, believing that Wilder was making fun of Hollywood. They also wanted her to take a screen test, which is a mark of shame for any actress of her stature at the time. It wasn't until director Cukor sat down with Swanson and declared it was the role she'd be remembered for that she accepted it.
Still wonderful, isn't it? And no dialogue. We didn't need dialogue. We had faces. There just aren't any faces like that anymore. Maybe one, Garbo. those idiot producers. Those imbeciles. Haven't they got any eyes? Have they forgotten what a star looks like? I'll show them. I'll be up there again, so help me.
For the role of Joe Gillis, the likes of Marlon Brando and Fred McMurray were considered initially. McMurray refused to do the film because he considered it morally offensive, though many assumed he just didn't want to be upstaged by whoever ended up playing Norma Desmond. Montgomery Clift secured the role for $5,000 a week for 12 weeks. However, 2 weeks before cameras started rolling, Clift dropped out. He cited that the film was too similar to his previous role in The Heiress, but many say that his relationship with Sigrid Libby Holman, who was an older woman that was in a relationship with him, who was significantly younger, was really the source behind it. After being under contract for nearly a decade with Paramount, they decided to consider William Holden. He met Billy Wilder for drinks and accepted the role, reportedly being offered far less than Montgomery Clift had. Holden was excited to take on the character, but he'd later tell his wife that the role terrified him. The movie started shooting on March 26 of 1949, shooting in continuity because the script was being written as it was filmed. The movie wrapped about 3 months later. The first test screening required cutting the original opening sequence, where Holden's character talks to the audience while lying on a slab in the city morgue. Unfortunately, audiences didn't interpret it the way Wilder envisioned it. They started laughing, setting off the wrong tone for the film. So Wilder decided to film the opening with the swimming pool that you now see. It's definitely a more somber introduction. When the film was later screened for several silent film stars, it's said that Mary Pickford walked out in anger, and studio head Louis B. Mayer declared, quote, "You bastard, you've disgraced the industry that made and fed you."
You heard him? I'm a star.
Norma, you're a woman of 50. Now grow up. There's nothing tragic about being 50. Not unless you try to be 25.
You're the greatest star of them all.
Goodbye, Norma.
Joe!
After a cross-country publicity tour led by Gloria Swanson, Sunset Boulevard would eventually gross $2.5 million in its initial release in the U.S., slightly short of the over $1 million that it took to make. By the 60s, though, the film had grossed $5 million. Reviews were initially glowing, and the film won Golden Globes for Best Motion Picture Drama, Best Actress in a Drama for Gloria Swanson, Director, and Score. The film was later nominated for 11 Academy Awards, but only won 3 for screenplay, score, and art direction. Both Gloria Swanson and her main competitor that year, Bette Davis for All About Eve, lost to Judy Holliday for Born Yesterday. Despite the praise for Swanson by both the public and her Hollywood compatriots, the film didn't give her the comeback that she'd hoped. Regardless, George Cukor was right. It's the film she's remembered for. Sunset Boulevard remains one of the landmark films of the 50s, it was put on the Library of Congress's National Registry in 1989, and is the 12th greatest American film of all time, according to a 1998 AFI poll. After the break, Diana Bosch joins me to get into the nitty-gritty of Sunset Boulevard.
Mr. DeMille, do you mind if I say a few words? Thank you. I just want to tell you all how happy I am to be back in the studio, making a picture again. You don't know how much I've missed all of you. And I promise you I'll never desert you again. Because after Salome, we'll make another picture and another picture. You see, this is my life. It always will be. There's nothing else. Just us. And the cameras. And those wonderful people out there in the dark. All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up.
Hello, everybody. Our main discussion for the month of April is all things William Holden, and I am joined by the William Holden girl herself, the amazing Diana Bosch. Diana, how are you today?
I am good. I'm so happy that that's my title. I wear it very proudly. I can't even recover from that.
Diana was just on the podcast, I want to say at the end of the year, talking about some of her classic film discoveries where we talked about Franco Tone. A little too much for my comfort because I don't like him. But Diana is just the William Holden aficionado, at least that I know. Diana, why don't you tell us about the William Holden project you've been doing this year?
I discovered William Holden, as I think a lot of people our age may have, is through I Love Lucy reruns. He's on the famous episode LA at Last. And I just thought he was so striking. I caught a couple of his movies on AMC back when it used to show classic movies. And I was just so struck by him because he was so different in every movie. The way he looked as well was different than the Gary Coopers and Robert Mitchums of classic Hollywood. He looked a little more relatable. And then when I read his story, I was so struck by his life. It is just so incredible. Famously known that he suffered from alcoholism, yet he lived such amazing life with wildlife conservation and challenging the studio system. He was one of the first to implement that he would get profits from the gross of the films. He produced one of his own films. He was really at the forefront of so many things that are commonplace now. But it just always struck me that he was able to do that while battling such a horrible disease. When I was researching about him, I was kind of upset that so many people just focused on the negative aspect of that when not really giving attention to what a productive member of society he was and how he changed the way we look at leading men. A lot of his characters, they had a vulnerability to them that let you see more of them as a whole versus being a rugged, tough, manly man that you would see in a John Wayne or Robert Mitchum. I started Holden 100 this year. It started on January 1st, which coincidentally was great because on that day, TCM was showing Born Yesterday, which is one of my favorite William Holden movies. I really like that because you were able to kick off watching him and being reminded of what an incredible talent he was. So every day I've been tweeting about his life. I'm doing it chronological order, focusing on really interesting things that we know about him, and all things that you might not know about him and his filmography. Interesting facts about the production behind his films. It's really been a great experience. So many people have responded in ways I didn't expect because he's not really talked about in the vein of those big name classic movie actors like Henry Fonda, like his contemporaries. That was upsetting to me because he did so many amazing roles, characters. I felt like you needed justice, and here I am to do it.
I support all of this. You took the words out of my mouth. I don't really know the first movie I saw William Holden in. It was either Sabrina or maybe The Moon is Blue, one of those. I think what makes William Holden so compelling compared to other actors of today, he always felt very modern. Even when he was playing period pieces, he feels like this man out of time. And he's an actor who always exudes sexuality, whether he's playing just a dapper young boy in our town or the character he's playing here. It's just impossible not to just fall in love with him, but actually physically lust after him. He's like Robert Mitchum to me in a lot of ways. Just characters that wore their sexuality on their sleeve, which is why it makes something like Rachel and the Stranger really funny, because they're two of the hottest men in classic Hollywood, and you have to believe that, like, one of them is threatened by the other for a woman. Sunset Boulevard is the apotheosis of Holden's career in the 50s. It's such an iconic part of the Hollywood, to quote Lena Lamont, the Hollywood firmament, in terms of how it portrays Hollywood looking back at itself. What was the experience like watching this for the first time? I'm sure you've seen this several times since, but the first time you watched it, what was your background with it?
Every time I watch it, I'm always impressed by his performance because it's such a departure from all his roles. Yes, he can be cynical in a lot of films, but you never really know how to react to his character. Is that something that you feel?
It is, because I think he's an actor that always could have easily rested on playing a villain. The hot guy who doesn't really care who he hurts type of thing, just because he's so impossibly good looking. And especially in something like Sunset Boulevard, where you're never really 100% sure, or at least I'm never 100% sure whether I'm supposed to like him or not. I don't know if I ever necessarily feel like we're supposed to like Joe Gillis, because much like Norma Desmond, he's an opportunist as well.
No, exactly. That's how I feel when I watch it, because am I supposed to root for this guy? Do I feel sorry for him? It's so interesting because with everything going on in Hollywood right now that we're being exposed to, it really shows you that this film could have been released today because it's that powerful and it has that sort of message. If you look at movies of William Holden's, you have his characters. They were always these men that were just so much more nuanced. They were heroes, but they could also not be heroes, or they were reluctant in a way in Bridge on the River Kwai and Salt Lake 17. So that's what I always appreciated. This was the first movie that I realized, oh, everything about him I've known has been wrong, because I think up until that point I had seen Sabrina, Love is a Many Splendored Thing, and Picnic, which are all like beautiful men that are like romantic and jerky.
If you look at his early career and where he started playing the all-American boy, I think of something like Dear Ruth, which I just watched the other day, and he's the poster child for World War II, the boys coming home. That had to get old for him. So in the 50s, you see this slight shift into Holden appreciating his ladies' man quality that I think was romantic back in the 50s. But for us, watching this in these films in 2018, stuff like Sabrina or The Moon is Blue or even this film, you're thinking, he's that guy. He's that guy that is like super nice to you. He knows all the right things to say, and then he totally seduces you, and then he moves on the next day, and yet you can't be mad at him because he's just so nice. That's the allure of Holden as an actor.
That era from the 40s, he was frustrated with those characters. He called them smiling Jims, saying that they had nothing to offer but to just smile and win the girl. So he was obviously frustrated. And I think that's why I'm also part of Holden 100. I'm watching all of his movies chronologically. I have so much more of an appreciation. But also, in movies like Invisible Stripes and Golden Boy, he was showing you different ways of manliness, I suppose, because he was letting himself show vulnerability, where at the time, that wasn't an option that many actors allowed themselves to do. That's why Sunset Boulevard's so special, is because this character, he's a kept man from this older woman that reverses the roles where men are the providers. And I just find those things so interesting because you never saw that on screen.
It's worth pointing out that William Holden was not the first choice for the character of Joe Gillis. They got Montgomery Clift to play the character, but Montgomery Clift felt uncomfortable playing the role because he was also, at that time, in a relationship with an older woman. He was essentially a kept man for a woman called Libby Holman. And he felt very uncomfortable playing the role and ended up leaving the project. They also offered this role to Fred McMurray, Marlon Brando, and Gene Kelly before they got to William Holden. There's some things to break down in what Wilder was looking for, because I think the way that the Joe Gillis character comes off in this film is unique. It's obvious he's a kept man, even though the movie really can't say that, and they certainly don't want you to think about the fact that these two are probably having sex, but they are. Whereas you get someone like Monty Clift, who is impossibly beautiful. There's a meekness to him, though, or at least in many of the films of his that I've watched. He's more of the babe in the woods to me, the wide-eyed ingenue, and I don't necessarily think that would work here. Same with, like, Fred McMurray. Brando's a little too hard. Gene Kelly's a little too florid. You really need somebody like Holden who's got that hard-boiled element to him, but is still not wearied and beaten down by the system. Just hot enough that you're like, okay, this man could have any woman he wants, but he's just poor enough that he was willing to do whatever he needs to succeed. What do you think about the original casting offers? Why do you think Holden works more than any of the other names I've mentioned?
You're right about looking the part. And William Holden looks like someone who has just enough experience to want to throw in the towel on the whole Hollywood system. Also someone who you could easily like say no to. Who would say no to Montgomery Clift?
Like, I feel like hitting a puppy.
I feel like people like that, people would want to have more mentors, someone to guide him. Whereas necessarily William Holden's character is just approachable enough to be one of those people to negotiate, and but also face the rejection that his character faced. That's what I'm talking about in the beginning part that leads him to the Norma Desmond past. And like Gene Kelly, I'm sorry, I just don't see him other than his musical films, which he is great. Like Inherit the Wind is amazing. at that time, I don't know if it would have worked because I don't think he had been given the experience to have that performance that William Holden gained. Marlon Brando, again,
it's a little too intense.
William Holden has the balance. There's just certain little things in the movie, like when he comes out of the pool, for example, she gives him the robe. You could see in his face where he's got this conflicting thing going on where it's like, what am I doing? Because this is going to amount to nothing. Like, he knows that her movie's never going to get made. But yet, his character that basically had nothing, and he's totally okay with living in this decaying spot and getting all these fancy suits.
The movie was very careful with his plotline. They did not want to label him as a gigolo. They didn't want audiences to necessarily think that the two of them are in some sort of sexual relationship. That's hard to buy, at least for me. And I'm sure Wilder thought that as well when he wrote it, because so much of the movie is reliant on, obviously, Norma's attraction for him. The way they lay on the couch together. The way he doesn't look at her. Or you bring up the swimming pool scene, which I think is the most obvious sign that there's a physical relationship between them. People, I think, forget how wary of touching the Breen office was about characters engaging in anything that was like skin-on-skin contact. For Norma to bring that towel up and start rubbing his body, I mean, that's risque, even for 1950. Mm-hmm. So I never bought, even though Wilder tried to downplay it as much as he could, they're in a sexual relationship. Is that how you took it?
Yeah, totally.
It's ridiculous to think that that's not, because I think that really makes you realize, and I hate, this sounds horrible, but I think it's how the film wants you to take it, how low Joe Gillis has fallen, that he's prostituting himself for a better life. This movie seems very conflicted about the concept of art versus commerce. He's not really okay with being given all these material possessions, but he gets used to them. Then eventually, once he gets all that, he realizes, I need to go to work. I need to make this movie. I need to leave a legacy. And I think that says more about Wilder than anything else, that concept of how do I appease my own need to create and still be able to appreciate the finer things of life. You bring up Nancy Olson. They did more than one film together, right?
They did 4 movies.
Oh my gosh, I only thought they did 2. It wasn't her earliest film, but it was her biggest film at that time.
Yeah.
They didn't want a name. They wanted a fresh-faced ingenue. And I think her and Holden have some cute chemistry. I don't think it's necessarily sizzling, but I like the two of them together. What did you think about their relationship and Nancy Olson's performance?
I love her. I think she's wonderful. And I think that she was perfect for the part because she's just this excited, wide-eyed girl that wants to be a screenwriter and make a legacy. And I think you need someone like that. But I think you also needed someone who was going to fight back and be freaked out when she gets the call from Norma Desmond. And she very much stands up to herself at the end. Even in the beginning, she wasn't no pushover. She was clearly like another, I hate to say the word because it's not very nice, but she's also a Hollywood opportunist. She is very much trying to find herself in this crazy game of selling her scripts and working in there. She's basically insults William Holden in the beginning.
I like that she's got that moment to insult him because it shows that she has integrity. She's a lot like Joe in that they both want to succeed, but she's going about it the right way. Their relationship does come out of the blue. I wanted it to be a bit more developed than I think it is. But at the same time, watching her and Norma have that phone call together is so powerful because it could have just easily been this big screaming match, but it doesn't. It's respectful. At least it tries to remain as civil as he can, even though Norma's obviously going off the deep end.
I just think she's a perfect blend of sweet but also strong. Nancy Olson's just a great actress because she's like William Holden, very approachable. She doesn't look like a Hollywood va-va-voom star. She had a comfortable career. She was great. I loved her in the Disney movies as well. She had a lot going on. Just really like their camaraderie in the movie. I have to agree. I feel like their kiss is a little forced because all of a sudden you're like, okay, that's where we're going, but we don't have much time left. But it's nice and tender because you see that there's a lot of respect between the two of them, regardless of the kiss scene. He shows an interest in her and sees that she has talent, and she
also knows that he has talent and wants to like bring it out from him. So I really like that dynamic.
Well, and you and I had talked about doing a full episode on this, and we figured we'll just do something different with the next episode. But we did want to talk briefly about SOB. I think it's William Holden's last movie in the 80s that has a similar bent to this film. I think it almost acts as a companion piece a little bit, both in terms of bookending his career, going from the film that is a legend to the film that he went out on. Both of them are dark Hollywood stories that ultimately, I think, it leads into a question I wanted to ask. What do we think he's saying with this? Because Wilder wanted to bring this movie to the screen. People were horrified. They were like, no, we're not going to lampoon Hollywood stars, and we're never going to acknowledge the fact that we abandoned these silent stars when they became irrelevant. Do you see this as a loving tribute or more of a scathing condemnation?
Going back to William Holden, he increasingly grew disenchanted with the Hollywood game. He was never very comfortable with going out and going to the strip club and chase-ins and stuff like that. He did, but he remained true to himself in ways of acknowledging that Hollywood wasn't as true to the moral values it tried to impose on people. There's an interview with him and his family at his home, and he said something that really summed it up for me. It was how he had started to do European films, and he was saying, I loved being on location, whereas on a set, you just build some Hong Kong, but you could actually go there and really get the culture on screen and capture that. That's what I would rather do. And that references Love is a Many Splendored Thing and World of Susie Wong, which were both filmed in Hong Kong. That's really important because he wanted films and, you know, Hollywood to speak the truth. And we know that they don't. And I think that's how Billy Wilder was as well. It was just a frustration. Yes, Hollywood sells a product and a lot of it is smoke and mirrors. But at the same time, there needs to be some sort of accountability. And I think exposing how ruthless of a business it is, because remember, it is a business. I think that's where they were coming from. Probably a lot deeper things, but I'm no Billy Wilder expert here. Because Billy Wilder benefited a lot from Hollywood. As an immigrant, he came here and he found footing in Hollywood. And I know it couldn't have been easy, but I feel like he had a respect for it, but at the same time was just frustrated by all the players mess things up. Like, he wanted to have the outlet to speak truth into these films, and he had to deal with censorship and the studio heads, and it was his way of coping with that and be like, you know what, this isn't how it should be.
Wilder, if you look at all of his films, I mean, he really embraces old studio filmmaking for the 1950s. He pushes the boundaries just enough. I think of something like Some Like It Hot. He's really fascinated with the early 20s as Hollywood was just trying to figure out what it was. By 1950, I think it's worth pointing out that the characters we see in the film are not starving. They still seemingly have very nice houses. That's not to say all silent film stars were monetarily well off. They weren't. Some, though, that had made a lot of money in the silent era were lucky, invested it wisely, and still were able to live in the lap of luxury. And of course, this is all before royalties and things like that were commonplace. So Norma Desmond lives in a very beautiful house. She's got everything that she could possibly want. The one thing she's hungry for is love, specifically love that comes from adoration from an adoring public. That's why her butler, Max, who's played by former director Eric von Stroheim, is the one that writes the fan letters. That was actually Eric von Stroheim's idea. He's the one who said, well, why don't we just have the butler send the letters? There's a little bit of both. There's both condemnation and adoration from Wilder. He reveres these actors for being able to live, but he's also saying we need to look at the cycle of commerce that cast them aside. When Norma goes to Paramount, she hangs out with Cecil B. DeMille. There's a patronizing tone to everything. It's just, oh, it's nice to see you. What have you been doing? It's just pleasant from him. He's not really interested in helping her or anything like that. It's really that age-old Hollywood story, which is everybody wants something from someone else. How do you let them down gently? But I think at the same time, Wilder is saying, we shouldn't have let these people down. We should have been able to find something. If anything, I think he's calling out the public for saying, you know, you consume these people for so long. And now that they're not relevant anymore, yeah. You guys are the ones who threw them aside. I think it's really subtly not only condemning Hollywood, but condemning the audience, who is so used to fresh product, fresh new faces. And what happens to the old face that you were once looking at? I think it's why people really enjoy the Waxworks scene. It's H.B. Warner, Buster Keaton, and Anna Q. Nilsson. If you look at Buster Keaton worked till he died. And part of that was he needed to. Part of that also was that he really didn't want to be forgotten by Hollywood. It's a sad movie, I think, on the side of it. Let's talk briefly about the 1950s itself. So we mentioned that people were really horrified when Wilder talked about making this movie. They had many ideas for Norma Desmond. They wanted Mary Pickford. Pola Negri was asked, but her accent was still too heavy for them to give it to her. Greta Garbo considered it, Norma Shearer, Mae West, and Mae Murray. Pickford and Murray were both horribly offended by being asked to star in this movie and were offended with the finished product. I think they said, what was it, Mary Pickford actually left the screening because she couldn't stand to watch this movie. Do you see anybody else other than Gloria Swanson playing in this role? And how do you reconcile with the fact that some of these actresses had thought that they were making this horrific film that totally made fun of them?
I don't feel that Sunset Boulevard makes fun of Norma Desmond. I think she was a big star and she should have received respect for all that she did. More than anything, it's a very deep commentary on this society that we've created as fans, as consumers, as the Hollywood producers. You put this person on this pedestal and then all of a sudden you're done with them for no reason, just because you got tired of them. And that's horrible. They're people at the end of the day. She lives alone in this decaying house and is just crying out to feel that connection again. It's just sad. And it also speaks as a cautionary tale to the society we have right now. You know, I think of a Norma Desmond and I think of the people we have that are on Instagram. You think of the Kim Kardashians of the world. What's going to happen when they're no longer relevant?
You look at actresses that were just starting out, especially someone like Mary Pickford, Norma Shearer. Those are two of the women that were so ingrained in Hollywood. Mary Pickford created it. Norma Shearer married into it. I mean, she married the biggest person that you could have married at that point in time in old Hollywood. I understand their immediate belief that, oh my gosh, this movie is making fun of us. At the same time, though, I think Norma Desmond, you brought up that it's a tragedy. Not only is it a tragedy from a Hollywood perspective, but just as a female. This woman is so desperate for someone to tell her that she's still useful. And I think a lot of that goes into the continued value we place on youth, especially if you're a woman. That concept that you're only as valuable as long as you're young and beautiful. What does that do to you when you're not valued that way anymore? It's something I don't even think we've answered in our society. I wanted to bring up Gloria Swanson because I think she's fantastic in this movie. She went to New York thinking that movies were done with her. She was going to work on the stage. When she got the role, she was only given $50,000 to star as Norma Desmond. This movie's made significantly more than $50,000. And she would stay in character during filming. We've seen, especially if you watched Twilight Zone's done this twice. Ida Lupino did an episode where she played a Norma Desmond-esque character that wishes she could actually go back to her films, literally. And Maggie McNamara plays an actress that's trying to...
Blake. Both those episodes.
I love both of those episodes. If you watch Sunset Boulevard, you really owe it to yourself to watch Ring-a-Ding Girl, which is the one with Maggie McNamara, and 16mm Shrine. Those, I think, are two very, very good companion pieces. Because all three of these things deal with women as actresses trying to figure out what to do with themselves. Gloria Swanson had a huge career. I mean, she had made countless movies. She's one of the wealthiest women. She also invested her money very wisely. She also slept with some very important people, including a Kennedy. I revere her for just being so tenacious. And this movie is a double-edged sword. Because it's the movie that makes her immortal, but it's also the movie that I think people assume Gloria Swanson actually was. What do you think about her performance and her as an actress?
Oh, I think it's phenomenal. And I think it's frustrating that the movie that they show that she's watching in Sunset Boulevard is really one of her big ones. People don't really respect silent movies as well as they should, because they had a lot of work to do. And Gloria Swanson was such a good performer for that medium because she had such striking features that could make her a villain or a heroine. She was just so incredible. What I love about Sunset Boulevard is she's not afraid to go to these places where women aren't necessarily talked about. When they show the makeover scene and that amazing shot of the magnifying glass showing her eye, what woman at that age was letting people have access to those features and showing them on these huge screens? It was such a risky performance. And she just goes to some dark places. I always walk away at the end of the movie just feeling so sad, because what did happen? What happened when she went to jail? Did she just die? Like Phil Gillis said, did the headlines kill her? Or does she even realize what's happening?
Well, and also like, there's an air of questioning whether, obviously, you're supposed to take away that she's crazy. It's a beautiful tragedy, but at the same time, I can't help but think that maybe Joe Gillis got what he deserved. There's this question of fame for him. He's always going to be famous as the victim of Norma Desmond. Spoiler alert, he's the guy in the pool. If you didn't already know that, you really should have. He's always going to be known as that person. They're always going to be inextricably linked to each other. So as much as he tried to get away from her, they are bound for life because of this cycle of death, which I think is really chilling when you really think about it. We bring up the twist really briefly, which was a rarity. This was not something that they did a lot of, especially having narration by the actor who is essentially dead this whole time. For people who don't really get into classic films that are so ubiquitous, can you enjoy this movie knowing who is in the pool?
I think so. I always say you have to watch in the beginning, because if you get midway through, you're confused. You're like, well, he's dead and he's narrating. If you like know the before going in, see that image, that's how it starts.
This is one of those movies I don't think is ruined by knowing the twist.
The twist is that she killed him. I don't think it's knowing that he's actually like dead and is the one that's talking. In the beginning, like he tells you that a big star like shot him. It's pretty blatantly set out, but what it takes to get there, I think, is more, if you miss that, then what's the point? I think Joe Gillis represents everything that killed her before he's even gone to her house, because he's the new Hollywood, a Hollywood that she doesn't recognize, nor does she fit into anymore. There's clearly animosity towards him, but also like her trying to get rid of that to use him so that she can return.
And I love that the pool, they actually drained it. They used it in Rebel Without a Cause. I didn't know if you knew that. The house was owned by John Paul Getty's ex-wife, and they actually drained the pool and used it later for Rebel Without a Cause, which I think is really fun. We have to talk about Billy Wilder, because his career leading up to this was successful. His career after this was successful. By the time this was nominated for an Academy Award, which this film did win Best Writing, Story, and Screenplay alongside Charles Brackett and D.M. Marshman Jr., who are credited with the script. He had already written an Academy Award winning screenplay, and he'd already won for Best Director for The Lost Weekend in 1946. And in between that, he had been nominated an additional 5 times, and he would go on to win another several Oscars. Louis B. Mayer said that this movie ruined cinema. It certainly didn't ruin Billy Wilder, because he went on to go make Ace in the Hole and Stalag 17 again with William Holden, Sabrina, 7-Year Itch, Love in the Afternoon, Witness for the Prosecution, and Some Like It Hot. That was all in the 50s alone. If anything, the person who is most successful in this movie, both on screen and off, is Billy Wilder. And this was his last collaboration with Charles Brackett. This was their 17th. You had mentioned, I think, on Twitter that you said this is one of the best scripts. Is that something you stand by now?
It's just one of the best written screenplays of all time. I don't know if it's Billy Wilder's best, but I just think it's up there. The way these characters speak, only they could say it, and they make it sound so natural. If you listen to the way Joe Gillis talks, I love the things that he says. People just don't think someone writes this dialogue. They think the actors make it up as they go along. These little nuanced things about being in Hollywood, only those type of characters could say that. They just come off so eloquent, but not fake and pandering. Like when he's talking to Betty Schaefer when they're making the script and she's like, don't you hate yourself? And he's like, all the time. And like, it just comes off so natural. And I just love that. And there's just so many deep parts in the movie within the dialogue that I just really love. We had faces then, and then I am big, it's the pictures that guy small. So many amazing one-liners that we take for granted now. He wrote with Charles Brackett, and they're just so good. They don't sound corny or anything.
I love the script for this. I like a lot of Wilder scripts. He's definitely great when it comes to the written word.
He's just so good. There's other deeper films like Ace in the Hole, and Dog 17 is so good. The pacing of it and not knowing who is the informant. It's one of the ones that I love a lot. It was his first, The Major and the Minor.
That's a great movie.
Like, we don't talk about it enough because it doesn't fly these days, but it's so funny. And I never feel like Ray Milland's predatory. I just think he's an idiot. But it's so good in the way it's written because he just doesn't get how weird the situation is. Obviously, the great hits like The Apartment and Witness for the Prosecution. Sunset Boulevard can be funny at times. And that's what's so great about it is his ability to go back and forth from this movie that could be really funny, but also very dark and film noir. And
Wilder is one of those. I think he both captures the humor and tragedy of life and about love. I mean, all of his relationships are incredibly fraught with lies. None of the relationships start from a place of truth. I think of something like The Apartment or Some Like It Hot, even something like The 7-Year Itch, even something like Sabrina. It's this concept of your relationships start based on lies. How do you deal with that going forward? Which I think is really inventive. They did bring this to Broadway back in the early 90s as a musical. Andrew Lloyd Webber, who did Phantom of the Opera, did a musical version of this. They recently brought it back last year. It recently ended its Broadway run back in June with Glenn Close playing Norma Desmond, and it was incredibly well received. And there's talk about remaking the movie now because supposedly Glenn Close is born to play Norma Desmond now. How do you feel about them trying to remake this?
I just want to stop remaking things. I'm not even one of like, oh, the original, like, because I think some things can be remade. We are such in a deep reboot, remake culture that I want to see the next Billy Wilder. I don't want to see a guy trying to be Billy Wilder. And that's what's really annoying. The musical is actually really good. I listened to the music recently because a friend of mine talked about it. I just never thought it could be a musical. Like,
I don't even know how that's possible either.
But the music is great and it's very good. But so here's the thing. Sunset Boulevard is a timeless story and it's something that could very well play as a cautionary tale in our culture, no matter when you look at it. I just feel like a remake would take away from the original. If they did the Broadway version as a movie, I think that's fine because that's its own original work that was adapted different. But I just feel like that's the same movie. Like, what's the point? I like the idea of making the musical into the movie just because I looked at some bootleg copies of it because I wanted to see what it would look like. And it looks phenomenal on the stage with this giant mansion. I was really surprised. But the words in that script are just so good. The performances are just iconic. Why take away from it?
Why ruin a good thing?
I don't have a problem with Broadway. There's that talk of West Side Story. I'm kind of like, you know what? Personally, I don't think Steven Spielberg should do it.
I don't think anybody should do it.
If you're trying to like make it actually Latinx, which the 1960 movie didn't really get, okay, that's great, but let one of us be in charge.
I swear, this is easily the third episode that I've done slowly making fun of West Side Story, or at least them remaking it. And I love West Side Story. But of course, Sunset Boulevard, we have to talk really briefly before we close out about awards. This was one of only 13 films that was nominated for the Big Six, which is Best Picture, Best Director, and all the acting categories. That was a rarity. Probably the most infamous thing was that Gloria Swanson didn't win Best Actress. She was actually beat by Judy Holliday for Born Yesterday. The rumor is that essentially Swanson and Bette Davis were the two front runners. Bette Davis had done All About Eve, and that the voting, the way it goes, split the vote, and we got a weird outlier, which is Judy Holliday. And this is an argument that it gets about as contentious as people who are Team Grace Kelly versus Team Judy Garland. Sorry, Team Judy forever. Grace Kelly does not deserve that Oscar. People get really animated about whether Judy Holliday won rightfully or whether it should have been either of the other two. What I'm asking, I guess, Diane, is explain yourself. What team are you on?
Okay. What a tough year. I can't imagine. I think that a lot of politics played into it, that maybe there were people there that just didn't want to award this film because they thought it was
offensive.
Yeah, I think that had a lot to do with it. What gets me is that I feel like Judy Holliday, Gloria Swanson, and Bette Davis all gave phenomenal performances. Each stand their own. What Judy Holliday does in Born Yesterday is so difficult as a comedian, stripping back the darkness of the situation she's in with Broderick Crawford and you feeling for her. That is the situation she put herself in. There's a lot going on there, and I love that performance. It's one of my favorite ones. And then Bette Davis, I mean, what can be said about All About Eve? It's hard because I've never really picked a team because I'm always like, why couldn't it just be a three-way tie? Or, you know, so many other movies, I've been like, that's the one that won. Like, I'm firmly Team Judy Garland. I will never watch The Country Girl again. I watched it once and I was so mad. And it has William Holden, and I wanted to throw my remote into the TV. I was so angry.
That's the right response.
It bums me out for Gloria Swanson because I feel like as Norma Desmond, that would have been such a perfect end to her. She finally would have gotten that respect. Famous photo of her finding out she lost next to Judy Holliday, and she's sobbing with Jose Ferrer, and it's just so heartbreaking because she's not Norma Desmond, but there were some elements where she definitely identified with her. And so the fact that she didn't get an Oscar just breaks my heart for her as a human.
I love all three of these movies equally. You brought up politics. I think that's very true because both of the movies that were in contention were entertainment-based movies. One of them is about stage. One of them is about film. And normally Hollywood really likes to reward itself, or at least the concept of like entertainment. Here you have two very bleak and cynical looks at Hollywood, whether it's the concept of throwing away the silent stars or the additional concept that often goes hand in hand, which is the new young upstarts that end up supplanting the older guard. It was the safe choice to go with a movie about political corruption and this need to educate yourself. You know, Judy Holliday's blonde and pretty, and she's got that voice. So I can see why they probably went that way. It makes sense to do it. Obviously, I think Diane and I both agree we recommend Sunset Boulevard. I think it's one of the bleaker films about the Hollywood experience that's not directed by Blake Edwards, but I love it a lot. Diana, what are your overall final thoughts on Sunset Boulevard?
This is one of the movies that I feel like if you haven't seen an old movie, this is a good place to start.
It's a very good introduction.
Because one of the things I hate about like people who don't know about old movies, they'll say, oh, black and white, it's so boring. Or there's other people that are like, the men were men and women were women. Or, oh, they just really didn't say anything. They were just like boring. You like had a happy ending. Goodbye. This film just strips all of those notions away and is a very daring piece of work. From the first shot of Joe Gillis in the pool, it's so like frightening. It's like, there he is, he's dead, and he's talking to you. But then it also has this commentary about media and a commentary about Hollywood and superficiality, us as people trying to make a legacy and what we do to find value in our work. And then the ultimate tragedy of Norma Desmond, which works so well in our current culture where we're trying to live for like social media gratification. There's just so much being said in this movie that it's timeless. Another thing too is, again, those quotes, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up. People have heard that. They know about that. I can't tell you how many times when I was a TV reporter and I would interview people, so many people would say, oh, I'm ready for my close-up. I don't think half of them knew where that came from. Knowing that this is the movie and having all those dots connected and then realizing like, wow, this is the movie that it came from and it's such a good movie, is really powerful. and that you see that movies like this were so good and you need to respect them. And like Kristen said, you have to know the history in order to be better.
Yes, before I burn down film Twitter again. It's definitely a very good introduction. The hardest thing is like, how do I get into classic films? Watch Sunset Boulevard. It's pretty great. Sunset Boulevard and like Singing in the Rain are two really good intros to silence versus transition to talkies. But you can let me know your thoughts on Sunset Boulevard and William Holden or whatever you want by emailing them to me at ticklishbiz@gmail.com and I'll read them on the next episode. I'd like to thank Diana Bosch once again for joining us today. Even though she'll be back next episode, Diana, where can fans find and get in touch with you online?
I run the blog Flickin' Out, and you can find that at flickinoutblog.com. I am also on Twitter at The Dame Upstairs.
That's going to close out this edition of Ticklish Business. You can listen to Ticklish Business a variety of different ways, either directly at ticklishbusiness.podbean.com, via Stitcher Radio and Player FM, or on iTunes. If you are listening via iTunes, please consider helping the podcast out by leaving a rating or review. As always, you can contact me directly at ticklishbiz, that's B-I-Z, at gmail.com, or visit me at my official website where I discuss classic films regularly, journeysinclassicfilm.com. Journeys in Classic Film is also going to be the host of all my written content as I cover the TCM Classic Film Festival yet again this year, as well as a new ongoing series I have called Boulevard of Broken Stars. I also have Kristen Recast the Classics, a lot of other things on the website, so definitely check it out if you haven't stopped by. The podcast is also on Twitter at ticklish_biz. Want to learn more about upcoming episodes or hear exclusive content before anyone else? Then consider supporting Ticklish Business via Patreon. I have a wealth of amazing perks, and all your donations go right back into making Ticklish Business the premier classic film podcast that it is. Also, anyone who becomes a patron in the month of April is eligible for a secret prize from the Ticklish Biz Vault. After a prolonged editing binge, Patreon subscribers can hear exclusively my interview with TCM On Location's tour guide Sarah Louise Lilly, and patrons are going to be getting exclusive access to all manner of content during this year's TCM Classic Film Festival. So if you're interested in becoming a patron, just head over to patreon.com/ticklishbiz. Want to learn more about the stars turning 100 this year? Well, if you're a member of TCM's exclusive fan club TCM Backlot, you can read my year-long series about the stars spotlighted this year on the podcast. I talk about films and other information that you won't hear on the show. Next time, Diana Bosch returns once again as we close out our Selennial tribute to William Holden while looking at our top 3 favorite Holden features. Till next time.